This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Across Australia on the Community Radio Network, to over 70 community stations around the nation. This is Word for Word, coming to you from Australia's LGBTI radio station, Joy.
Welcome friends, family, fans and fiends to my fifth edition of Word for Word. I want to thank you for tuning in today as I am Benjamin Norris and this is my 16-week series of LGBTI influencers. Each week we will sit down with those who have inspired us, entertained us, and mostly they've made an impact on the queer community. Today, our guest is known for her work as an LGBTI activist. You've actually been the creative director at one point, and now you're the campaign director for Get Up, is that right?
That's right.
Which is a left-wing political lobby group.
We'd say sort of a progressive grassroots movement of 1 million Australians taking action, but sure, lobby group is fine.
Lobby group is it's all good as well. This fabulous woman was the finalist for the Honor Awards Young Achiever Award in 2015. You were also in good company when you featured in the top 25 LGBTI Australians to watch in 2016, and you won the New South Wales Honour Award as a Young Achiever. These are pretty amazing things.
Thank you.
Please welcome Sally Rugg.
Sally Rugg from Get Up.
We have this huge once-in-a-lifetime opportunity.
Today we're making history.
Create an Australia that values all love equally.
I'm a human rights campaigner at Get Up and I love being a lesbian.
I will keep campaigning for marriage equality until all Australians are treated equally under the law.
Is it interesting to think that you've made such an impact and that people know who you are?
It's amazing. It's really flattering and it's really, I don't know, this is an honour to be mentioned and to be suggested to you as someone to speak to. So, yeah, it's great.
Can you tell us a little bit about your childhood when you were growing up in Perth?
I grew up in Fremantle. I've got two younger sisters. We all went to school around there. Was really into gymnastics and musical instruments. And then I went to high school and I did my undergrad in Perth as well. When I was 21, I moved to Melbourne and then I moved to London and then I moved to Sydney.
And what were you like as a child?
My mum describes me as very determined. She always tells these stories about how But if I put my mind to something or if I decided something, she couldn't stop me. There was nothing that could stop me from doing that.
Interesting.
Well, I was the oldest of, three girls. So, I don't know, I suppose I was like, the things that come with being an oldest child. Like, I would like to think that perhaps I was like a bit of a leader in the family or like a bit of a, maybe a caregiver to my younger siblings.
Do they see you like that?
I think so, but, like, I'm not always in a good way, maybe.
Let's get them on the phone. We'll find out. Like, I think it's an interesting thing when you are the oldest. I mean, you do sort of gravitate towards having those traits. But those traits, for you, really set the tone for your career.
Yeah, I think so. It's funny, I was in this, this is a little side story, but we'll come back to the point. I was in this book club a couple of years ago with a bunch of other activist women, like leaders of, you know, various activists, not just like environmental stuff and human rights, whatever. And we had been doing this book club for months and months and months, and then all of a sudden we realised that all nine of us, were all the oldest daughter of three children. And then we decided that, like, maybe there is something about being, like, the oldest child and you get into activism. Or maybe it was just a wild coincidence.
It could be a wild coincidence, but I reckon for anyone out there that's listening now who are the oldest, they're like, no. They're like, no, hang on a sec. When you're the oldest, you know, you probably are a bit of an activist in your own right. I guess people are looking up to you.
Yeah, I suppose that's right. And certainly because I was such a determined / maybe insubordinate child, I think that also kind of predisposed me to activism. I've never liked being told what to do.
What about in relationships? Are you tameable in a relationship?
No, I mean, I think I'm very different in relationships than I am, like, in my... So in work settings, I think that I am, like, very... I don't want to say combative, but just sort of, like, I'm not afraid of conflict or confrontation. I'm very determined and very hardworking and very sort of like driven with purpose and stuff like that. Whereas in a relationship, I feel like I avoid conflict, and I think that relationships should be full of love and compromise and tenderness.
And championing them to be the best version
of
themselves.
Yeah, and it's being in a relationship isn't about yourself, it's about the other person. Which I suppose activism is like that as well. But yeah, I think I'm different in relationships. I'm tame in relationships.
It's probably the wrong word for me to be using. Really need to go back.
Are you asking me a sex question?
You're like, let's get really personal.
Can you be tamed in the bedroom?
It certainly wasn't supposed to be like that. You know what's interesting, though? When we're younger, though, we sort of determine, like, we start to work out who we are. Like, our personalities start to form. Do you think from working at your sexuality that you've changed a lot in your personality compared to what you were like when you were younger?
No, I don't think so. I don't think I've changed at all, but I do think that, like, parts of when I realised I was gay, then, like, parts of myself became clearer, or perhaps I had a more comprehensive sort of like appreciation for myself, maybe. But no, I don't think it changed who I was.
I guess because we spend time in the closet as we're working out our own sexuality, sometimes that can stilter us a little bit. Mm. You know, did you struggle with coming out with your family?
Not really, because I had a sort of strange experience, I suppose. Like, I didn't realise I was gay until it was like this penny drop moment where I was like, oh my God, everything makes sense. You know, in that moment, it was really scary, and it was, you know, I've made this comparison before, but it felt like discovering I had cancer. Like, all of a sudden, having this thing that was inside me and part of me, like, I didn't choose it and I couldn't control it and it wasn't going away, and you know, you can't just ignore it. Like, I would have to deal with it somehow. And so that feeling of feeling really frightened, and also that, you know, the big wide world that I was just stepping out into as a sort of 19-year-old was all of a sudden going to be hostile towards me.
And that was your feeling that you had?
Yeah, just that I wouldn't be able to navigate the world. I wouldn't be able to achieve my goals or, like, pursue what I wanted to do in my life, or, you know, have loving and meaningful relationships because I was gay, and that meant that, you know, I was wrong, you know, something wrong with me. But those feelings, like, quite quickly subsided, I suppose. Like,
Do you feel like you've ever been held back because of your sexuality?
Like, yeah. I mean, not in terms of my career, because I'm, like, gay for a living now, but, yeah, I mean, there's been multiple times where, you know, an ex-girlfriend and I were denied a lease. Like, we were denied a house because we were a gay couple, and, you know, various ways that you sort of alter your behaviour in public, or you don't tell the taxi driver that you're going home to your girlfriend because you're just like, I don't know if that's going to... You change and alter your behaviour constantly. And that moment is what has driven a lot of my activism, because I don't think any young person, when they're making the discovery of who they are and who they are going to fall in love with, they shouldn't feel afraid. Like, you shouldn't feel like... you have cancer. Like,
I know, but that's so
loved.
Scary. Like, even as you were using that term, scary to think, and it's upsetting to think that when we do work out our sexuality, that the fear is as strong as we feel like it could mean death.
Mm.
You know, and I think that that's interesting. And will that begin to change, or do you think that people forever, as they work out their sexuality, will always be concerned?
I dream of a time when nobody feels afraid of being queer. Nobody is afraid of themselves or for their children if they're queer. You know, that's what drives me. Like, in all my work, is about making sure young people are safe,
feel loved.
Yeah, and they know that no matter who they are, they're worthy, and that we want them to be here.
What did your parents think when you told them? What did your parents think of you telling them that you were a lesbian?
Well, I'm just trying to remember when I told my mum. I think I was living in Melbourne by then and had a girlfriend, and I think I texted her and was like, guess what? I have a girlfriend. Bye.
Bomb drop microphone.
It wasn't a huge deal. And she's so supportive now. And, you know, like, she's been supportive of me for the last 10 years. But there was something really emotional about seeing her and my sisters cast a vote in the postal survey. Like, I hate the postal survey so much. I will never forgive our government for putting us through that. But, yeah, seeing my family tick a box to vote for me was both... It was both a beautiful moment of acceptance and love and support, and also such a weird, alienating moment. Like, I haven't felt unequal or different from my family since that moment 10 years ago when I was like, oh, no, I'm gay. Like, something's wrong with me. I'm different. Like, I haven't had that feeling since with my family. But having them all get a vote on my rights under the law, it really brought up that feeling again.
I think that's one of the sad things, though, with a lot of people, is that we have this big fear of when we come out that things are going to change. But I always say to young people, the worst part about coming out is just getting it out of you and saying that I am gay, I am whatever part of the queer alphabet you determine yourself to be. But then after you've told people, the response is, I think... never as bad as what you've made it up to be in your head.
I hope so, yeah. I think that's, like, good advice for a lot of cases, but certainly, like, not for all. Like, people shouldn't come out if they're not going to be safe, if they don't have the supports around them. Like, it's always better to be out with support and love, but if that's not going to be there, like, people have got to make sure they're safe and seek the support and love first.
I reckon I'm in a bubble. I must have been in a gay bubble, and maybe that has to do with the fact that my sexuality was more known to other people from such a young age due to my camp extroverted nature, you know, which means it's easier in some ways to see that from boys than maybe it is to determine that with girls.
Mm.
But did people work your sexuality out before you did?
Yeah, definitely. Like, all through high school, I got called Rug Muncher, like Sally Rug Muncher, which I think...
Well, that's clever, guys.
So funny now. And so I spent my whole high school being like, I'm not. And then all of a sudden I was like, oh, I am.
Sally Rug.
But also, like, I was, you know, having sex with women. So, like, of course the rumour mill starts. But
what age was that you started having sex with women?
Before I realised I was gay.
Yeah.
Which...
Such personal questions. Tell me about your first sexual experience, Sally.
It seems like such wild cognitive dissonance, and I suppose it was, but this is another thing. I think, like, growing up, I didn't... Like, the first portrayal of a LGBTI or, like, a queer woman in pop culture or in my life was Alex on The OC. She was, like, the first lesbian I ever saw on TV and stuff. But I think as well, like, when you grow up and you don't have that representation around you, like, I was, like I said, I was hooking up with women and, like, feeling attracted to women, but it just didn't occur to me that maybe I was gay because this is...
But that's because there probably wasn't... people out on television and
that's what I mean
in media, which means that we didn't really have really strong role models to identify with. And podcasts or radio shows like this, where we're openly talking about our sexuality, is actually putting something out into the community for people to listen to, and they can go, oh, it's okay. Because I don't think before, when we were growing up, that you could Google Sally Rug or someone like you and have that information on hand. What do you think the younger version of yourself would think now that we can Google your name and find out some really impressive things about you?
Oh, that's like a really nice thing to think about, actually. I think she'd be really, like, proud, I guess, impressed.
I'm an emotional nightmare. My partner's always like, oh, God, Ben's emotional. But I always think that's such a beautiful thing, though, to think back to your younger self and with the fear and the worry and the concern about where you're going to go in life, but then to also see that your journey leads to somewhere being so powerful and thought-provoking and a part of the community.
Mm. I think, so we're doing a bit of time travel here, but if young Sally Googled my name and saw the stuff that popped up on Google, I think she would be like, wow. But actually, like, the things that I am most proud of in my life, they don't come up on Google. Do you know what I mean? Like, Google is sort of like an award I got or something I've written or, you know, something like that. But the things I'm most proud of, I don't think, you know, a 10-year-old Sally would...
Understand the value.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's true. I think that is true because of the things that you have, and we're going to get into that. Like, your achievements probably are not straight away what you would have thought you'd be doing when you were younger.
Mm.
But then you've gone on to do them, and you've gone on to do them and be very successful, which, you know, is quite amazing. When you were going through the whole coming out process for you personally, were there any really big struggles for that?
Yeah, like the fear that I described before, that moment of thinking that my life would be completely different, and then there was nothing I could do to stop it. It was this permanent change inside me.
And what brought you out of that? What do you reckon changed to make you... Because now when we sit here and have this conversation, you're confident and happy and it's obviously different.
I think just, like, a bit of time to process stuff. Just that fear faded. And then you meet more queer people, and then you fall in love, and then it's you find the beauty and the community and everything that is so wonderful about being queer. And then that little fear you had at the beginning seems so small and so young, and while it was so real at the time, it's just a memory now.
You've really woken up people, I think, in a way, talking about your story. Did you always feel that you had this inside of you to be this open?
Like, just naturally, I'm not very sort of, like, prone to privacy. I am a very open person. So I think I'm a very open person, and I, you know, in my work in the creative director role at GetUp and also just in activism, one of the most powerful ways to make change, or is to galvanise people to make change, is by sharing stories and telling stories and connecting with people that way. And I also, you know, LGBTI justice has always been built on the back of people telling stories. You know, the marriage equality campaign, for instance, like, when the campaign started decades ago, but, you know, in earnest probably about 13 years ago when it really, really started in Australia, you know, public support for marriage, there was no public support for marriage equality. People didn't understand why LGBTI people would want to get married and why they should be able to. So the first really significant piece of work in that campaign was trying to explain to people, oh no, I'm just like you, like, our relationship is just like yours, look at my family, look at the love we have, let me tell you about our Christmas mornings, or we want to tell you about how we first met, or, you know, how my partner makes us happy. So that opening yourself up to share stories to kind of humanize yourself, I suppose, is a real pillar of activism in general, but I think mostly, in particular, LGBTI justice.
What did you do when you were in London?
Well, when I moved to London, I was with my first true love. And so we both worked full-time, but we just spent most of our free time just, like, staring into each other's eyes, being like, I love you.
Living in
not
this
quite,
London
yeah,
experience.
Exactly.
And
we were just...
being in love.
Young and in love and in London.
Do you still speak to her?
No. I do not.
How long are you with her for?
4 years.
Wow. And then is she still in London?
No, she and her new partner live in Perth.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think, you know, that's... I think for me, I know this sounds strange to say, I mean, I'm in a relationship of 8 years and I have had, like, 4-year relationships. You know, they're all little journeys in their own way and they don't always mean that you're going to stay friends with them forever, but they still play a very important part.
Absolutely.
You know, in your life.
Yeah, of course.
So you kind of look at them and go, oh, I wish that didn't happen. You kind of go, well, no, that was a beautiful story for that time.
Yeah, I don't regret any of the relationships I've been in. Like, they've all been beautiful and kind, and, you know, even if they have ended and we don't speak anymore, like, it's still, you know, worthwhile. And
you still look back at it fondly in a way.
Yeah, absolutely.
Getting into your career, how did you end up becoming this person that you are today? Like, what did you study originally?
I did my undergrad in Perth, and I did communication and culture studies.
Okay.
And then while this is a bit of a tangential thing for my career, I don't even think it's even that relevant. But while I was doing my undergrad and also while I was in high school, I got a job at Boost Juice, like when I was 14 or something, 13, 9 months, 14, just at like the local Boost Juice shop, and then kind of just never left Boost Juice. And so I worked there for like 8 years and just like worked my way up the ranks of Boost Juice. And so then after my undergrad finished, I moved to Melbourne to work at Boost Juice head office.
Get out of town.
No, I'm serious. Like, I was in this national role.
Are you still secretly working at Boost Juice?
No, I still drink Boost Juice though. but yeah, so I worked at Boost Juice head office, just like, hey, what's up, Janine? And then moved back to Sydney, or moved to Sydney, where I did my master's in journalism at UTS, broadcast journalism, which I didn't finish, but did that for a couple of years. And then while I was working at UTS doing broadcast journalism, I got a job at an organisation, like an NGO, that was adjacent to the Royal Commission into Child Abuse. So I did that for about a year, and then also got a job at GetUp, because I was studying and I had this little NGO job and I wanted one extra day of work. And I saw a job at GetUp pop up on Twitter and I was like, oh, sick, I love GetUp. That's cool.
Can you explain what GetUp is to me?
GetUp's been around for about 12 years now. And there's over a million of us now. There's 1.3 million, I think. But we started out, but basically as a, like, ordinary people can participate in democracy sort of like at elections, and there wasn't much opportunity for ordinary people to, you know, if the government was doing something that you disagreed with, or if some, you know, corporation is, you know, taking the piss or whatever, we felt that there was a space for like ordinary people to organize together and take action and apply sort of grassroots pressure and people power onto decision makers, essentially. So that's kind of the theory of GetUp. But we're a movement of over a million people who take action on issues of human rights, environmental justice, so like climate, environment, economic fairness, and democracy. So if you are a GetUp, if you're a member of GetUp, you, like, we send you emails letting you know, like, oh my God, Peter Dutton is trying to do this thing. Can you contact your local MP and tell them you don't want that to happen? Or, hey, there's a rally this Saturday and can you come along? Because, you know, if we can get a lot of people at this rally, then the media's going to show up. If we get media coverage, it'll tick over to tomorrow and then, you know, politicians will be forced to talk about it. Or, you know, it's trying to organise ordinary people to use the power that they have to influence decisions that get made, and so to try and make a country a more progressive place. So, like, GetUp has been campaigning on marriage equality for 10 years.
Wow.
And, like, our members played a huge role over the course of that time in initially, like, getting the public support for marriage equality, then using that public support to apply pressure on individual MPs, get them to support marriage equality until we had a majority in both houses of parliament. And then the plebiscite was announced, and then GetUp members worked really, really hard and managed to block the plebiscite legislation, which was amazing. And then when we were forced to this postal survey, GetUp members were right at the front of the Yes campaign with a bunch of other organisations, making phone calls and having conversations, turning out the vote. So, yeah.
Powerful stuff, though. For a young person to be getting involved with GetUp, it's just proof that, you know, you had a belief in yourself and you have a belief in your thoughts on what needs to be changed.
Yeah.
You've also been actively involved in safe schools.
Yeah, so when the attacks against safe schools started in earnest, I was part of and remain part of sort of like grassroots activist groups. So it's separate from GetUp, but just sort of grassroots activists and LGBTI community members who have, you know, were organising to try and stop the attacks on safe schools and from safe schools getting axed, essentially.
Why do people have such a big problem against safe schools?
Because there are some really loud voices in the media and in Parliament, particularly in the media, who have run a campaign against the program and have been allowed to spread complete misinformation, really like fear-mongering lies about a program that is like at best really wonderful and at worst kind of innocuous. Like, the Safe Schools program is, I don't know if you've read it, but it's, like, gentle and sensible and was implemented while Tony Abbott was Prime Minister. It was brought in under the Abbott government. It was reviewed by the Coalition's Education Ministry. It was then independently reviewed by an independent panel who found it to be entirely age-appropriate, completely in line with the curriculum. It's voluntary, like, there's, it's, yeah.
Well, what's the biggest misconception?
You know, you hear stories of, you know, mothers saying, the teacher brought a dildo into my year two classroom. Like, what? Like, in what world is a teacher bringing a dildo into a primary school? Like, it's just not happening. But the
And that's what's still attached to it, though. Like, when you talk about safe schools at a dinner party,
people are like, oh, God, wasn't it that thing where, you know, kids were being taught about S&M? Like, what? No. But
who are those people, though?
So, I mean, it's organisations like the Australian Christian Lobby, who are, like, really extreme far-right groups who sort of go under the guise of being Christians, but they're anti-LGBTI groups, essentially, who get their funding from anti-LGBTI groups in the States and sort of various churches. So really, like, murky, gross stuff.
Extremists.
Yeah, they're religious extremists. People like George Christensen, who is he's a Queensland MP, who, you know, has likened the Safe Schools program to pedophile grooming, which is just, this is a program designed to help teachers know, you know, if a kid in their class has same-sex parents, the teachers can go to the Safe Schools program to be like, ooh, like, what am I meant to do on Father's Day? You know, like,
just to be able to arm people with the right information.
Yeah, it's a resource for teachers. Or like, oh no, like, you know, one of my kids is transgender. Like, what are my responsibilities here? Or what language am I meant to use? Like, it's a resource for teachers.
Where are we at with Safe Schools now?
It's in every school in Victoria, which is brilliant. We've just got Labor governments in Queensland and in WA, so they're Safe Schools states. Basically, we have more schools that are signed up to the Safe Schools program than ever before. Yeah, but New South Wales has just defunded it, so we've lost a whole bunch there. But it's part of the Labor Party policy, as it used to be with the Liberal government before all these completely bizarre attacks. So I mean, I'm hoping that if there's a Labor government at the next election, then it'll just be available to any teacher who wants to use the resource.
So working with, you know, getting the right information out about Safe Schools, that's sort of coming under GetUp, and this is where you've been. We were joking about this before, but, you know, your title's been kind of changed after this plebiscite activism that you've been involved in.
Mm-hmm.
So what do you classify yourself as now?
Well, I'm still at GetUp, and we'll go back to GetUp soon, but I'm going on holiday for like 3 months. So
to where, girlfriend?
I'm going home to Fremantle tomorrow.
Oh, that'd be lovely.
And then I'm going to a gay wedding in Melbourne, except it's just called a wedding now. And then I'm working on another few projects and stuff. But I'll go back to GetUp and I'll be a campaign director. Yeah,
back working on getting that information out there.
Mm.
When was the moment that you realised that you could make an impact on society?
Well, obviously it's because of the role I'm in. I'm given this extraordinary platform because I represent GetUp members who, you know, this is their work, essentially. It's powered by their donations. Like, if I ask them to sign a petition, nothing happens unless all these people sign it. Or, you know, if I organise a rally, it doesn't make the news unless people come. So the reason why my name would be everywhere is because I'm in this position representing so many GetUp members, I suppose. I also, like, tweet a lot, so maybe that's why.
The thing is, you can tweet a lot, but that doesn't necessarily mean that your opinions are valid or respected. And your opinions are valid and are very respected. Where do you think that comes from?
I'm obsessed with marriage equality and was obsessed with this campaign for 5 years. Like, the injustice of it drove me wild, and the ridiculous, pointless delays and factional politicking just, like, drove me round the bend. Like, I suppose I had opinions that people listened to or were deemed to sort of, like, have authority because I think about this issue all the time. So perhaps was, like, an expert on it.
I'm jealous of it, though. I think I'd love to be a good writer or have better grammar or make the impact that you've made. And I think you do make an impact on social media, but you also make an impact in person with the way that you are interacting with other people. You know, these are hard qualities to have. Who would you like to work with?
Well, Magda, obviously. Magda Szubanski. I don't know doing what. Like, I don't think I have any skills to offer her, but I'd go get her coffee. And
there's a lot of people talking in the media about Magda, about the fact that, yes, she's a prolific entertainer, but with prolific entertainers in the last 4 years, we've seen people take on roles of being the President of the United States. Mm. And so there are celebrities now moving their way into having an active voice that is respected by the community. Mm. Would there be any thoughts of maybe being like a campaign manager and getting Magda involved with politics?
Oh, God, that is the best idea I've ever heard. That's it. I'm sorted.
What are your thoughts on celebrities having now active voices?
Well, celebrities have always had active voices, right? They've got really loud voices.
They do, but at the same time, I don't necessarily think in Australia we've ever seen a person put their heart and soul on the line like we did with Magda throughout the plebiscite, and to have a very well-respected Australian as a voice offering a platform for people to digest where we were coming from was incredibly important. Mm. And I think that there's a real opportunity for someone like Magda to continue in politics.
Totally. And the thing with Magda, it's like what I was saying before, like about how with LGBTI issues, our progress is built on the back of people opening up and sharing their stories. Mm. So, you know, there have been celebrities that go into politics, but like, you know, Peter Garrett, for instance, didn't, you know, go into politics talking about his music. He went into politics sort of talking about the environment and the education ministry for a while. You know, like, whereas Magda, like, the fundamental work she was doing on the postal survey was, again, opening herself up to the entire country because she's got a profile. Magda for Prime Minister.
What would you say, including the work that you did on the plebiscite, but also just looking back holistically at your life, like, what are you most proud of?
I think the proudest singular moment of my life was being up in the gallery when the bill passed and the law changed. That was the most incredible, I want to say surreal, but it wasn't surreal because I've been dreaming of it for so long. It was the most beautiful moment of my whole life. You know, like I mentioned earlier about the sort of phases of the marriage equality campaign. I was talking about sharing personal stories and how the first half was getting public support. The second part was about targeting individual MPs and trying to get them to support marriage equality. And, you know, a matter of years ago, we only had, you know, a dozen MPs who supported marriage equality. Like, people in politics didn't support this change. And I remember, like, spending months, if not years, on individual MPs, like, getting local activists to lobby that MP and targeting them with advertising campaigns and writing to them and trying to convince these individual MPs to support marriage equality. And one by one, over the years, these politicians switched their support, right? And I remember sort of late 2015, I remember they're ticking over to a majority of people, of MPs supporting marriage equality in the House of Representatives. And this was still only, you know, it was like half plus one. Like, we had just scraped through. And the reason I tell this is because sitting up in the public gallery and looking down onto the chamber floor, I don't know if you've seen that photo, every MP except for four have moved to the right-hand side of the chamber. They're all voted yes. Like, I remember when there would have only been 12 or 15 on that side and there was, you know, over 100. It was just the most beautiful thing. And I think, you know, I mentioned before how I've been obsessed with this campaign for a very long time, but when the postal survey announcement came through, the yes result, that was great, but that wasn't the campaign to me. That wasn't what we've been working on for the last 13 years.
Yeah.
What we've been working on is getting the law changed in Parliament. So looking down and seeing just everybody to the right of the chair, which is where you cast your yes vote, was so incredible. And that was the proudest
moment for you.
Yeah.
Well, who was the company that you were keeping? For people who didn't see that photo.
So I was sitting next to Karen Phelps and her wife and their daughter. And then we were sitting next to Christine Forster, who I believe is someone else you're speaking to, mm-hmm. her wife Virginia. And then next to Virginia was Magda Szybanski, who I love. I don't know if I mentioned her. And then it's getting a bit further down the left-hand side now. And then Ian Thorpe was there, maybe a couple of seats down from her, and then Tom and Brooke, who were drivers of the campaign. Mm. So, yeah, it was pretty amazing. But we were stuck in the public gallery for 8.5 hours or something wild, with no food, no water, no...
And I remember Virginia saying to me that it was like being on Survivor.
It was like being on Survivor. And we all went a little bit crazy. Like, we went stir-crazy because we were... And we weren't even really allowed to speak that much, but that ended up... We ended up getting quite noisy to the point where the speaker down in Parliament kept having to be like, order, like, order in the gallery.
And there was a rumour about that there was a decision being made on, once it happened, that there was going to be a song that you were going to sing.
Yeah, well, so about, I think it was probably about midday, we started saying, okay, well, like, what song are we going to sing when we win? And there was a lot of ideas being tossed around.
What were they?
So one cohort of people wanted to sing the national anthem.
Uh-huh.
Another cohort of people wanted to sing Love is in the Air.
Wouldn't it have been amazing if the doors just opened and John Paul Young came out singing Love is in the Air?
Would have been amazing.
Like the music video. Have you seen the music video? That's just all angels and everything. Another song?
I think they were the main two, Backwards and Forwards, and then We Are Australian was suggested to sort of, because those two, we couldn't decide between those two. And so We Are Australian was put forward as a kind of something in the middle because it was still sort of Australian and celebratory without being the anthem, which really alienates sort of Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people. And, you know, it's a lot of people have mixed feelings about that song. And Love is in the Air is a beautiful song, but a lot of the families there were like, well, our kids don't know this song. We should sing something our kids know.
It's such a powerful moment, though.
It was amazing.
And then that's going to be there for, you know, for all time, which you just think, oh, just to be able to sit amongst those people, be a part of that whole thing must have felt great.
My mum watched the video afterwards that I'm sure everybody has seen by now of us all singing in the gallery and was like, oh, my God, I could hear your voice singing really loud. And I was like, I didn't have the heart to correct it. And I was singing, but I was crying so much that I was like... like struggling to, like, I could not have been singing loud enough for her to hear. But I'll let her have that.
Well, for her, she was just, I think, proud. And I think in her mind, your voice had been so strong throughout the whole thing. She probably, in a way, felt that she knew that you were singing it, you know, which again loops you all the way back through to what your proud moments are, a culmination of family and work that you put together for this plebiscite. And then to get to go and sit there in that, up there, just in that auditorium is just crazy. Now, looking at some of the LGBTI themes, because, you know, that's kind of what we're doing while we're sitting here. And looking across the landscape, Australia really has had a journey, I'd say, with our sexuality. What do you think that journey has been?
The journey has been too long and it has been violent and heartbreaking and isolating and then triumphant and brave and enterprising and ongoing. This is, you know, this is by no means the end of any journey. You know, justice and progress doesn't happen in one linear single track work stream. It's not like, you know, first we did decriminalisation and then next up on the agenda we are going to solve the AIDS crisis and then coming up next we're going to, you know, it's not like,
no,
this work happens all the time in ebbs and flows in this massive spectrum of activism led by different people. And, you know, marriage equality has been a huge campaign of the last decade, and I think will be a really, really significant moment both in our history and also as we look forward. I really think it there's a massive step of progress.
What's it like to be a gay person in Australia at the moment?
I think it's a little bit happier, a little bit safer, I would like to think. It's a little bit more loving, a little bit more joyful, I suppose. I would like to think. you know, my hope is that a generation of people grow up, whether they're queer or not queer, seeing these photos, knowing that LGBTI people can get married, knowing that their relationships are just as equal as anybody else's, and then that will have a massive flow-on impact for, you know, how queer people are treated in every aspect of life, and also how, you know, all of society understands diversity and difference and gender and sex. And, you know, I think it's a really, it's amazing that people can get married now, absolutely, but I think there's huge narrative benefits that will trickle down.
And then looking into the future as well, I mean, there's still quite a lot of homophobia in this country, you know. I mean, there has been a huge change, but, you know, looking forward, what do you think some of our continuing struggles are?
A really significant and pressing issue is that the barriers that transgender people face when they are seeking employment, seeking housing, seeking appropriate healthcare. So those sort of the systematic barriers that marginalise transgender people is really urgent and really pressing. It's not as clean cut as marriage equality. Marriage equality is just like changing one law. So I mean, and progress is being made to, you know, support transgender people to become less marginalised all the time. It's not like, righto, now we'll start on this project. You know, work has been happening for decades, being led by incredible transgender activists who are already doing this work and already having incredible successes. The day after marriage equality passed, the courts ruled that transgender kids who are seeking stage 2 hormone treatment will no longer have to go through the family court. Australia was the only country in the world that made children and their families go to court to get medical care. Like, you just see your doctor, please. So that was an incredible, huge victory, because it means that trans teenagers can access this care. They can access this treatment without this enormous financial burden of going through the courts.
And really, that's a decision that needs to be made in the home. I mean, obviously, you're going to talk to your medical practitioner about it, but it's still something that people in the home should be discussing.
Yep, absolutely. So now, yeah, so that's really great. And that's just an example. Like, it's not as if that work on that particular court case and all the activism and advocacy that surrounded that, it's not as if all that work was put on hold while marriage equality was happening. Certainly marriage equality would have sucked public energy away from, like, literally every other issue for the past 6 months. But, the work is happening. The work is already being done. So in terms of what's next, it'll be around trans people being able to access housing, employment, safety.
Playing such an active role in all of this, do people come up to you on the street or wherever you go out and say, to ask you about your story?
They don't ask me about my story. They'll say, like I do sometimes, get stopped in the street.
Get the high fives.
Yeah. A lot of people are like, hey, I saw you in that video. I'm like, yes, you did. It depends where I am. If I'm in sort of Newtown or Darlinghurst or whatever, and there's lots of queer people around, they'll sort of say thank you.
So people do recognise you quite often and come up to you and say, well done, or thank you.
Yeah.
I think that's a really nice, you know, it's a really nice place to be. Over this series, I talk about this one thing, which I don't necessarily know how you feel about it, but I feel like for a very long time, the community was talking about the sex, and like with things like Mardi Gras was very sexualized. And we then sort of changed things to then talking about equality. Do you think that there was a real tipping point with that? Do you think it was more palatable for us to stop pushing the sex forward and talk more about love?
I like that you call it the sex.
I'm, you know, the sex. It makes it sound.
Have you heard of it? I don't know if, I know what you mean, but I don't know if I agree. I think Mardi Gras is still super sexualized, as it should be. I mean, I think sex and pride in sexuality, I think, is, like, I think it's a part of the queer community, because for so long we were criminalised, we were stigmatised, we were medicalised for the type of sex that we have. And so being able to reclaim sexuality and sexual expression and feel really proud of that is actually, I think, like an act of community building and an act of protest and an act of celebration. having said that, like in terms of the postal survey, for instance, where every single Tom, Dick and Harry in the country gets a vote, like, sure, it's like it's not strategic to, you know, for me to be in an interview and start talking about anal sex, for instance. Like, that's not going to...
That's too graphic.
Yeah, like, that's not going to sway an undecided voter. Like, you would, like I was saying earlier, you would tell the stories of, you know, how, you know, I first met my partner here and this is what our family is like and we dream to get married so we can, you know, just like our brothers and sisters. You know, you would talk about an issue that people can relate to, that people aren't confused or frightened by. So, yeah, certainly in the postal survey we didn't shout about sex a lot. But, marriage equality isn't really about sex.
No, but if you looked at a lot of the protests that had been happening, or not protests, but if you'd seen a lot of the marches over the years, I mean, the numbers were astronomical, you know, for these marches that happened. But if you look back at photos of people protesting the same thing 10 years ago, there was a lot more imagery being used towards our sexuality, which were completely absent from what I could see.
Yeah, certainly the most recent rallies, there were some great signs, but they were all, like, funny. Like, they were joke signs. Like, the sort of the proposition you're putting forward, I reckon, like, my sense is that because we were in a postal survey and because we had a no campaign, like, there have always been opponents of marriage equality, some with very loud voices and in positions of power. But because there was a organised no campaign that was given 50% of all media opportunities, that was always there to balance. You can't see my air quotes. I do to air quote balance out the conversation. Then I think, you know, these people in the no campaign were so hasty and eager to paint marriage equality supporters as sort of like deviants and pedophiles and, you know, perverts and all this sort of stuff. So, like, I wonder if because there were these people ready to pounce, to vilify people, to demonise people, maybe people toned that back. But I, you know, there was certainly no, like, decree from on high that from now on we're going to stop wearing dildos to marches or whatever.
There was not, like, an email went around and said, guys, just, did you get the memo about the strap-on? We're leaving them at home. What hurt, do you reckon? What do you think hurt for you, though, the most through that no campaign?
Oh, so much. Honestly, the most painful moment for me throughout the whole postal survey was when my ballot arrived at my house, like this letter with my name on it and with a form inside asking me to cast a vote on...
That hurt.
Yeah, on my worthiness, you know, on whether my friends are good parents to their children, on whether I deserve a right in this country. That, yeah, receiving that ballot paper at my house was so upsetting. And also, like, as a campaigner, you know, as we've spoken about, like, I worked with many other activists for 2 years stopping a plebiscite, and we won. Like, Parliament blocked legislation for a plebiscite. The public rejected the idea of a plebiscite, became incredibly unpopular. A plebiscite is a really abhorrent, undemocratic, inherently discriminatory process. So to have successfully blocked this thing and then be forced to have a postal survey anyway...
It was disrespectful.
Yeah, and just sort of holding this piece of paper in my hand felt like... It felt like a, you know, an affront, but also a failure. I felt like I'd failed as a campaigner. I felt like I had failed to protect the vulnerable people in my community who would be going through the exact same thing. I mean, you would have got a letter to your house with your name on it and your address.
I was too busy getting ready to take my Instagram photo of me posting it.
Well, that's good. Like, and that was part of the campaign. We wanted people to be like, hooray, we posted.
I just focused a lot of my energy, but during that time was living in a rural area. I focused my energy on being positive about it. And then I did come to Melbourne before the postal vote was calculated and we got our result. And I noticed amongst my friends and amongst the community that people were tired. People were exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
And that was really hurtful for me. That was the thing that I just noticed. Some of the language that people were using during that time meant that they'd been deeply affected, and that bothered me.
Absolutely. I mean, every time I saw my friends, you know, every conversation would start with, and how are you going? Are you all right? You know, just checking in.
Mm.
And, you know, people in the community were just all constantly reaching out and checking in on each other and looking after each other because it was really awful.
Considering that we got the vote of yes, considering that happened, what do you think now? Do you think that... Are you happy that Malcolm Turnbull put that forward?
The postal survey?
Mm.
No, it should not have happened under any circumstances.
Even considering that we got the result that we did?
It absolutely should not have happened. And I think it is... The process, not the result, the process of holding a postal survey is like one of the most shameful things that the Australian government has done.
Bob Hawke said this is the sign of a bad government.
Mm-hmm. We could have had, you know, I mentioned it a few times now, but when we could have passed that law 2 years ago, we had the numbers in the House. So the fact that we've got marriage equality after a postal survey, like, yes, in terms of, you know, consecutively, we did get marriage equality after we had a postal survey, but we didn't get marriage equality because of a postal survey. It was completely unnecessary. It was unbinding. It had no bearing on whether the government could pass a law. So we shouldn't have had that postal survey. We just should have passed the law.
As maybe the face of the lesbian community, a part of the queer community, if you walked into a room and Malcolm Turnbull was there, what would you say to him?
I'd probably say the same thing that I just said to you.
It shouldn't have happened.
It shouldn't have happened. And he can, you know, I remember, and Magda and I were talking about this, the day the law changed, Malcolm Turnbull was in Parliament banging on about how wonderful this was and this was incredible and... talking about the postal survey. Marriage equality is wonderful and unifying and beautiful for the country, but he was talking about the postal survey being wonderful, and that just absolutely reverberated within the queer community because there was this man who had put us and our friends through the most traumatic, unnecessary time, and for him to stand up there and sort of bleat about how it was some sort of wonderful personal achievement and we should all be grateful, if I had an audience with Malcolm Turnbull, I would want him to understand that people died, like, people died during the postal survey, and friends of mine couldn't leave the house because they were worried about being targeted in the street, you know, whether they would be or not, like that. This fear that the country is casting judgment over you and that you're under this intense scrutiny, I would tell Malcolm that it's nothing to be proud of.
So you're certainly not going to be one of those people on your dinner party set tables. You know when people play those games? Who would you invite to your dinner? Would you invite Malcolm Turnbull?
I'd invite Dean Smith, Liberal senator who wrote the bill.
You'd invite him to come along?
Of course.
That's a good question. Who does Sally Rugg have as three people that you would have to a dinner party?
Politicians or just anybody?
Anybody. Dead or alive, you can do them all.
Oh, my goodness, you've really put me on the spot. Can they be fictional characters? Can I invite Alex from The OC? But not the actress, I want the character.
And I'm going to say no.
Oh.
No, I'm not going to say no. Yeah, go three characters, three anybodies.
So Alex from The OC, I would invite... Harry Styles, because I love him. Like, I really love him.
I love Harry Styles as well.
He's so beautiful and talented.
Have you ever watched his... We're going off on a real tangent here.
I don't know what you're going to say, but yes, I have watched it.
Yeah, I love when he sits down with Grimace on BBC One and has conversations. There's something
Well, they
very...
were dating for a while.
Do you know that to be true?
Yes. Mate, everybody knows that to be true.
Do they?
Yeah, yes.
Oh, see, I just never really put two and two together. I know I've listened to so many stories, and the fact that they sit there talking about their love of The Notebook and stuff like that, you're like, oh, okay. Interesting. Learn a new thing every day. Have I been under a rock not to know that?
I don't know how to answer that question without being mean. Yes, you have.
Well, that's so funny, though, that when you think about, you know, sexuality, that it probably will be... less of a sign of the times.
Just a few.
We'll turn this studio into a karaoke booth for Harry Styles. But isn't it funny that people like Harry Styles with their sexuality are so less likely to talk about it?
But he talks about it. You're just not up with the Harry Styles.
Just not been listening to him properly.
And the third person I would choose would be my niece, Penny, because she's the love of my life. She's 2.5 and I just want to see her. I can't wait.
So
she's
going
to be in my fantasy dinner.
Fantasy dinner is Harry Styles, your niece, and a fictional character from the OC, a TV program that has not been on television since 2005.
Yeah.
I want to come. Alrighty, well, look, before we go, I think it's important for us to say this, and I'm very proud of you, and I think that you are an amazing person. And whilst people are listening to this across Australia, do you have anything to say to the queer community?
To the queer community? Yeah, I have so much to say to you. I love you. What I would say is that together, these last few months have been really hard. I know that, but as someone who has had the honour of, again, having this bird's eye view of everything that's going on in this country, both for the marriage equality campaign but also other activism, we are stronger than ever before. We are vibrant and creative and resilient, and it has been so incredible watching the work and the sense of community that everybody has put out during this time. And I'm really looking forward to Mardi Gras. That's what I would say to the queer community. But by nature of being part of the LGBTI community, you are part of the LGBTI family, and I love you.
Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much for listening. Sally Rugg, thank you so much for being able to come into the studio and share your story. You are a powerful, impressive person, and I'm sure the rest of the community that has listened to this want to thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
Word for Word is presented and produced by Benjamin Norris from Australia's LGBTI radio station Joy. Word for Word is distributed nationally to over 70 radio stations across the community radio network.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.